everybody. Welcome to Nevada Backcountry. Dave and I have been out of pocket for a little while. I was dealing with an illness that I thought only 12-year-olds get, but let me tell you, hand, foot, and mouth, no joke.
Well, it felt that you were 12. Mentally.
Mentally. Yeah,
physically, mentally, yes.
Yeah, I was back there, buddy. It was rough, but hey, we're happy to be doing the show again this Sunday. First, shout out to our sponsors, Out West Buildings and Truck Envy. Great companies. They've stepped up. They are supporting the show, so we can't thank them enough on that. Now, moving past all that stuff, Dave and I have been doing a little bit of shooting lately.
Yes, we have. We have been fortunate enough to get out to Winnemucca, to the Winnemucca Archers Indoor 3D Shoot. That was our first one of the year. That was an absolute blast. We both did pretty well.
Yeah, we both. You wound up in a shoot-off for first place. I think I wound up in fourth overall, fifth maybe overall.
Yeah, in Outlaw Division, yeah.
Yeah, Outlaw.
This last weekend was the first annual Fallon Bowman Indoor Championship or shoot at the C3 Arena, the new arena there in Fallon, if you have a chance to get
by. And man, that's incredible.
Oh man, what a great facility. And I gotta give it out to the Fallon Bowman. They put on a great shoot.
Oh,
The club did a great job, had things set up. You know, I wish the 12s were where my arrows landed.
Yeah, same
so
here.
So that was, but hey, I still shot. I felt I shot really well. My arrows went where I was aiming, just it wasn't where the 12 ring was.
Well, and let's talk about that for a second, because after Winnemucca, I was riding pretty high. My first 3D tournament ever, I think I was in second place at the end of the first day. I wound up, I think it was fifth overall after the second day of shooting. That was not the case in Fallon. I don't know. I think some of the stuff we've discussed, the off-center 12 rings, the competition. To give you an example, in Winnemucca, to make the cutoff for the final flights on the second day, you needed a 278 in my division. You needed a 278 or higher. At Fallon, it was a 306 or higher.
Yeah.
Significant jump in scoring.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. You know, Nevada has some phenomenal shooters. There's men and women, they can really get out there. IBO is a tough series to shoot in. IBO, there's no marks on the animal to aim for. You have to know where the 12 ring is on the animal. You have a 12, 10, 8, and then anywhere else on the animal is 6 points. So you're really focusing on where that 12 ring is. A lot of folks have what are called IBO cards. You know, it's a little card they carry on their quiver.
Cheat sheet thing.
And I need to order some of those because...
Same here, yeah.
You know, I'd look in binocs, I'm like, oh, I think that's the 12. And I'd zone in on it, get the pin on there, hold, it break, boom. All right. Hit that spot, walk up there and like, huh.
It
wasn't the 12. So those cards are really, really beneficial. So it's a really challenge. But again, the shooters in the state are awesome. I mean, there are several folks out there that are going to be tough to
hang with.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was no joke. I mean, the skill level out there was, again, significant jump, or at least scoring wise, from Winnemucca. Another thing too, though, I wanted to bring up. So this is a little hard for radio. Those listening out there, kind of picture a traditional archery target, like a bullseye target. And there is a set of concentric circles that get smaller and smaller and smaller. And in the very center is the bullseye. I had, again, being new to this whole thing, I had never seen this before. I feel like at Winnemucca, the 12 ring or the highest scoring ring possible was generally in the center.
Correct.
Like what you think of as a traditional archery target.
Yes, yes.
At this shoot in Fallon, they had, and they warned everybody, they said there are off-center 12 rings. And I kind of thought, well, I don't know what that means, but whatever, I'm here to have a good time. Well, when I got up and I looked at the targets, I realized it wasn't concentric circles. There may be an off-centered ring that you have to hit where the risk-reward factor is, you know, if you're off by an inch at the Winnemucca shoot, you would still pull a 10.
Yeah.
At this shoot,
you'd be an 8 or a 5.
8, yeah.
So think of a circle and then put another much smaller circle at 7 o'clock on the line of that bigger circle.
That's a better way to describe it. Yeah.
So So now instead of aiming for the center, you're like, oh, heck, do I want to go for that 12? Because if I'm just a hair left or even a hair low, I'm now an 8 or I'm a 5.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a poker game. Like, do I want to take the chance? Do I want to do this? So I took the chance on the ones that I could figure out. Oh, that one's offset.
Yeah.
Did okay, but few, you know. Anyway, it was a fantastic shoot. And today they are out there in Yerington, Nevada, shooting the Walker River Rendezvous. Another great shoot out there. Wonderful weekend. Got the 70s happening. So hopefully everyone is listening to us out there in Yerington.
Hey, you can stream it.
And you can stream it. So, and then the one after that will be a local shoot here in Reno. It is the Silver Arrow Bowman Bonanza. That will be held on the 15th and the 16th up at the archery shooting facility out there in Lemon Valley. So the club has been working really hard, cleaning things up, getting everything dialed in, the targets set and everything. The club out there has just been doing a fantastic job kind of revamping that place as well as the club itself. Give a lot of credit out there to James Pekka, the president, getting that organization back on track. It's been really awesome.
Let's talk about this for a second. Are both of those known yardage? And for those listening, there's two types of 3D shoot. Well, there's more than two, but for the sake of being concise on this, there's kind of two different types of 3D shoots. There's known or marked yardage shoots and unknown or unmarked yardage shoots. So the ones that we both did, Winnemucca and Fallon, they were a marked yardage. So you would go up and it would tell you, this is your target and it is at 37 point whatever yards or 76 point whatever yards. The Walker River Rendezvous and the Silver Arrow Bowman shoots, are those known yardage shoots?
Yes, those are marked. So the SAB Silver Arrow Bowman shoot will be Saturday. You'll go up. If you want, you can go up there and pay just a little bit less, and it'll be a fun shoot. You just go up there, have a good time. You shoot all the targets, have a good time. Then you have the competitive side of it, where you pay, you know, I think it's like five or so dollars more to register, but you are competing for the championship belt buckle. So on Saturday, you'll shoot very similar to Winnemucca and Fallon. You'll shoot on Saturday, then you'll be flighted for Sunday, and you'll be put into your group categories of
Based on your score from Saturday.
And then you will shoot for the belt buckle if you're in the top flight.
Okay.
Which is generally, I think, anywhere from, you know, 5 to 8 people, you know, top 5 shooters in that division. So,
okay.
It's good. Hopefully that should be another awesome weekend, as well as that weekend you could come out to Cabela's. Cabela's is having a community event out there. Myself and one of my board members, Pat Latimer, will be out at Cabela's for Nevada Bowhunters Association.
And when is that's this weekend
that
or
is
going to
be April? That'll be April 15th from 11 to 2.
Oh, okay.
Cabela's. It's like a community outreach event. People come out, you know, getting spring fever going and figuring out things that they can do as spring is coming up. And they can come out and meet us for Nevada Bowhunters Association and talk about the shoots and getting ready for archery or learning about archery and stuff like that. So, but we will be out at SAB on Sunday shooting.
Okay, and now, correct me if I'm wrong, but are you guys, you're still giving away a prime bow, right?
Correct, we
so
are.
When you're at Cabela's, can people buy in on that?
We are working on figuring out a way to get some of the tickets. I've got to grab some of the tickets, and you'll be able to purchase a ticket to win a fully decked out, ready to hunt with prime bow. It's about a $2,300 setup.
Coming up after the break, we're going to dive into antelope and mule deer, talk about some of the changes in the surveys from the 2021 to 2022. There's some big changes there. So we'll talk a little bit about that on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. And we are back on Nevada Backcountry, brought to you by Out West Buildings and Truck Envy. So over the break, David and I were kind of chatting a little bit about mule deer, and I was sharing with him, there's an area where my daughter and I go to shoot, and on the drive out there, there's a bowl up on top of the mountain that always loads up with deer, and we usually stop, you know, get the binos out, the spotting scope, and watch this herd of deer, look for good bucks in there. Well, we haven't seen them this year, and part of the reason is that whole bowl is socked in with snow. So, David, talk to me a little bit about the effects this winter is going to have on the mule deer population, and where the heck are they right now?
Well, most likely right now, they're probably coming down a lot lower to where they can actually get to food.
That would make sense.
You'll be out there, and you'll see deer and antelope and animals in general, just kind of even cattle, you know, sitting there hoofing at the ground to kind of get the clear the snow and stuff out of the way so they can get to the grasses underneath. It's a little tougher for them to do it when there's, you know, 4 or 5 feet of it. Plus, you know, skinny legs like that, they just drop down like sticks.
Punch right through.
This year, you're going to see the healthy ones probably doing just fine. They're going to get through this winter just fine. The nice, healthy bucks,
older age class.
Yeah, the older ones. You know, this is probably going to have a hit on the old and the young and the weak.
Right.
We may
right.
not see any effects in relations to our hunting seasons this year, but there will probably be something noticeable. I don't know what that might be, like at what scale that might be in the next, you know, next year out to the next 2 or 3 years.
Gotcha.
From what is happening, what may happen or occur this year with the deer herds.
So there's the immediate effect of just kind of dispersing herds or moving them into areas you normally wouldn't find them in if we weren't having such a heavy winter. But then the long-term effect on the overall herd numbers.
The reproduction of them. You're going to have some fawns that aren't going to make it. The weaker ones are not going to make it. Some of the older ones that don't have the stamina or the ability to burn that kind of energy at the rate that they're required to burn right now in order to maintain that body fat and that body condition, we're going to lose them. That's going to affect reproduction. Those animals that we're going to be able to reproduce next year, the year after next or something, well, they're gone. They're going to be out of the population because they didn't make it through the winter. So it'll have a kind of like a domino effect.
Yeah, and I know Endow has a pretty robust monitoring program survey program. So I'm sure they'll publish this stuff at some point once they start seeing numbers and kind of finally determining what the effect this winter. And man, has it been a winter?
And they have a great program on monitoring and getting the counts for all the species, all the wildlife species in our state. You know, these types of winters are not, they don't see this kind of stuff on record. It's not like you're getting a notice like, hey, an email from Mother Nature saying, hey,
By the way,
guess
what?
I'm going
to screw up every plan you got this year.
So, yeah, it makes it tough. So,
and then what were some of the changes? You had some of the changes from the last big survey period. What was it? It was 21 and 22 was the last big survey period, I think.
Like this year, you know, we're all getting ready to put in for our tags and stuff. So as you start looking at some of the statistics from 21 to 22, you'll see some of the areas have really, I wouldn't say bounced back, but the number of 4 points or better have increased. The percentage has increased a pretty decent amount. You know, from 21, I would have to say, in 2021, I'm saying, the harvest rate in area 18 that was 4 point or better was somewhere like 26%. And in 22, it jumped all the way to like 38%. So you're seeing some areas where they're starting to harvest some larger class animals.
And 18, that's Stillwaters, Clan Alpines, okay.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that whole area there. And it all depends on what you're really gearing towards. You know, there are a few areas in the state where you can have the quantity of deer and still have the probability of finding and getting to, like the quality bucks. You've got over 800 tags in area 6-1, 6-2, 6-4, 6-6, 6-7, and 6-8, I think it is.
Okay.
With the bulk of the harvest in 22 being in 0-6-2, over 300 deer harvested in that particular unit.
Man.
Yeah. And 91 of those deer were 3-point or better. Out of that, I mean, they had a percentage of 35% of all of those deer were 4-point or better.
Whoa,
so you still have a lot of deer and you still have the opportunity of having some quality deer there and in area 7, 7-1 through 7-9. And I think that also includes 091 as one of the units.
Is 091 real quick? Is that weird border unit out by Wendover?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of had a reputation for a while for producing quality bucks.
Oh yeah. I mean, they harvested some really nice ones. And again, that one too is 075. That particular unit itself, out of those 800 plus tags, 300 of them came out of 075. So if you're looking for a spot where you're going to get into, you're going to see deer.
Right.
And, you know, you have a good chance of seeing some quality deer. Those are two good spots to go. Now, if you're just going out there and just going, I want to see some deer, I would like to just harvest something, area 10 is always a good place to go. There's
pretty easy to draw, too.
Yeah, almost 900 tags in that area. It might be a little tough to get away from other hunters if that's your objective, but if you don't mind seeing a few hunters on the mountain as well, you have at least a good opportunity to have a good time out there and get out in the wilderness and just enjoy a couple days out there where in that area it's like 26% were 4-point or better. I mean, not a great percentage, but you're going to see deer.
Yeah, and it's an easier draw, and I would use, we had him on the show, Chris Costin from the Muley Fanatic Foundation.
Oh, heck yeah.
He and his brother, man, they took a bomber buck out of Unit 10 last year, archery hunting, and they went steep and deep in Unit 10 and got it done.
They're there. The bulk of the sportsmen out there probably won't, you know, throw on the backpack and hike
and
in
go
four
that
or
hard.
Five miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's only a few of us that do that, and I'm not sure how many more years I've got that in me.
Plenty, Dave. Plenty.
Hopefully, man. Touching 55 this year, so... But anyway, I mean, there are phenomenal deer in every unit if you've got the if you've got the stamina to do it. Other than that, there's a couple other spots, you know, you could really think about and do some research on. Some of the best areas for like 4-point or better or some of the bigger bucks in this state would be 081. Last year there were 44 tags in that area and 86% of them were 4-point or better. Couple out of that area that were, you know, 5-6 point plus, and they were smokers. Another good one is area 242. 50 tags in that area, I think, last year, 76% of them were 4-point or better. The bulk of them taken in area 242. The tag, I think, is like 242 through 243 and then 245. And to give you a little bit on that, the Silver State tag, the Heritage tag, and the Dream tag were all taken out of that area.
Oh, another one of those border units with Utah. And
exactly.
I don't know, I've always heard that those herds kind of move across, back and forth across the border. I don't know if there's any truth to that.
I mean, they move back and forth between the two states fairly regularly based on seasonality, based on food, based on, you know, what it might be. And they're going to cruise back and forth.
Yeah, what a testament to that unit, though, that, what'd you say, Silver State?
The Silver State, the Heritage, and the Dream Tags all came out of that area. The
242?
Yeah, 241 to 243. Two of them were shot out of 242, and the Dream Tag was taken out of 241.
You know, I've never put in for those units. I always kind of think like, man, that's a heck of a long drive from Reno to get down there. But
all the Vegas folks and all the, you know, Tonopah, Vegas, Ely folks, that's just
their
a
area.
Sky.
I might need to reassess, man. I might need to put in for some of those units because I'm sure I'm not the only one. I'm sure people listening out there have that same thing. I've always heard, oh, those border units with Idaho. Best shot at a 200-inch deer is one of these border units with Idaho, but... I might rethink that this year and start looking at some of those southern units as well.
Yeah, they're great. And I mean, well, and then you got Central Nevada. All of Central Nevada is, there's a fair amount of tags that are offered in area of 14, 15, 17, and 18.
Right.
They're all over 100 tags in that area. And their 4-point or better percentage is above average. You know, you got anywhere from like 34% to 50%.
Which is nothing to scoff at. I mean, 50% or more of the deer coming out of some of those units were 4-point or better. That's pretty darn good.
That is really good.
It's better than the deer I killed last year.
Well, you know, it's just a matter of what you're looking for. And then putting in the time to get out there and try to locate. Because a lot of these areas are enormous. I mean, Area 16 is huge. Area 10, huge areas.
Right.
It's tough to pack your gear and then just drive out there one day and go, huh, I've never been out here, but I'm going to hunt Area 10. You're like, well, it's like a third of the state. We're going to take a short break right now. And coming up after the break, we're going to get into some antelope locations for our tag applications. So stay tuned. We will be right back on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
Hey, thanks for hanging in there over the break, everybody. We're back on Nevada Backcountry, and we're going to talk about speed goats, antelope. Over the break, David, I was sharing with you, this sounds egotistical. I don't mean it to be. Generally speaking, if I have an elk tag or a mule deer tag in my pocket, I can look at a map and kind of narrow down a few areas where I know, like, okay, generally deer are going to hang out here. Elk herds are going to hang out here. I have a starting point to, you know, start scouting and begin my hunt. Antelope frustrate me to no end. Cannot do the same thing with them. I've come across them at 9,200-ish feet on the side of Spruce Mountain. I've come across them 20 miles from any wrinkle in a topographical map out in the middle of a sage flat. No rhyme or reason to why they're there. So frustrating to say the least. But that's my experience with antelope. You?
Same thing. I cannot seem to pattern them. I know that when we go out on an antelope hunt, I know generally where to look.
You are better than I am, for sure.
Well, it doesn't always work out that way. You know, we'll get out there and we may not see anything. And then, like you said, you'll have to go to a completely different spot that you wouldn't think antelope would be. A lot of people say, oh, you'll never see an antelope in a canyon. Their eyesight's too good. They can't see around themselves because everything's so close.
Right.
I would beg to differ. I've seen antelope in very steep, nasty canyons just bedded down. And I'm like, where'd y'all, what happened? Is this like timeout zone or something?
Y'all did got you not trouble? Get the memo?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be here.
Yeah. So no, you do. You definitely have to really think about your antelope hunts. I mean, I do. My son he got his first antelope tag at 14, and he ended up shooting with his bow an absolute smoker for his first buck.
That's right. We talked about that with Jason from Pope and Young. You were saying, first antelope buck with a bow was just phenomenal.
Yeah, and I told him, don't ever think that that's going to happen again.
Forever ruined.
And the hunt was over not even an hour into opening morning. I mean, that thing came into us like it was on a string.
That's awesome.
Him and all of his ladies, and they just, it was insane. I was like, that's awesome.
Were you guys, you were sitting water?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the extent of my antelope hunting tactics is glass your rear end off and then find water and sit and keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, we scouted the daylights out of the place, and this particular antelope we never saw, but we saw some other nice ones in that area. And like I told my son, I'm not a sitter. If anyone knows me out there, I cannot sit for very long. And I told him, okay, we're going to sit water for maybe an hour, hour and a half after sunup, and then we're out of here. We're spotting and stalking because I'm not sitting here for 16 hours. So, but it all worked out for him.
We had kind of touched on this off air, but antelope are not going to be affected like mule deer, elk with this heavy winter. Generally, the terrain they hang out in.
No, it shouldn't. It's not going to have as much of an effect as it will, like you stated, on deer or elk. You know, and possibly some sheep herds and stuff. But
right.
You know, they're probably going to struggle a little bit, but not as much.
Yeah. Now, everything we said about how hard they are to, maybe not necessarily how hard they are to find, but the random locations that you find them in, we are going to try to give the listeners a heads up on some of the better units in the state for producing quality antelope. I see you looking at the book there. What you got for me, Dave?
Well, over the last few years, there's a couple spots in the state that have been really been the hot spots for folks to put in to find, that 15 plus inch, mid 80s antelope, and some of them, mid 80s to much larger. That's area 7. Area 7 has been really good. Area 078 has been a real hot spot for folks. They've been really clamoring to grab that tag. My buddy had the tag last year and he shot himself a nice animal. He didn't get the one he wanted, but he got himself a nice one. And that's generally how it goes,
Right. Oh yeah.
You see the one you want, and you're like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to spend the rest of the time hunting him," and then you never see him again. One of the areas though that has really popped up is area 211, which is, 211 through 213. There's only a few tags in there. I think there's only like 5 or 6 tags in that area, but last year 60% of them were 15 inches or bigger.
I'm cheating here. I'm looking at the GMU or the game management unit map. 211, 213, that's down there like on the border with California. I don't know anything about those units.
Yeah. No, it's great country. They're beautiful areas. I've been out there a little bit, and it's beautiful country, and there's a lot of antelope out there.
Obviously quality antelope as well.
Yeah, it's just another one of those spots that seems to be popping up. Another good one, if you're looking, so my wife she just wants something with horns longer than its ears. She's harvested horns shorter than ears, and she's like, "I want something with longer than ears."
She wants a buck.
She wants a buck. That's what she wants. She's not looking for the big monster screamer, which, as most of us know, the people that end up not wanting one of those ends up like, "Oh, look what I just shot."
Yeah. exactly.
So some of the good spots you can get into and still find some decent mid-70s to upper-70s animals. We're talking like 012 to 4, 015, get into 031, near Winnemucca, northwest of Winnemucca, get up in there.
Yeah, the Eugene's out there.
Yeah.
04, whatever that is.
The Seven Troughs area, 041 to 046.
Yeah, that area, there's tons of antelope out there. I've seen good antelope, but it's definitely a quantity over quality.
Yeah, those are some good spots that I'd recommend. Always the 6s and the 7s. There's a lot of antelope out there. And I know last year on an elk hunt, there were a bunch of really nice, really, really nice, not last year, year before last, bucks chasing their herd. We just sat up on the mountain and just watched them just rag themselves to death chasing girls.
What unit was that?
That was 061.
061. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We're up there just up on the top there just watching. And there were a lot of antelope. I'll bet you, and I'm not fudging around, but there must have been at least 70 to 100 antelope. We were able to, from the mountain that we were on, we were able to cover a lot of country. So,
big area.
But there were antelope all through that area. And that's another good area. So if you're not interested in, you just want the meat, like right now, I would just want to fill my freezer with some more antelope meat. So I'm going for shorter than ears again this year. I'll put in for longer than ears, but I'm definitely putting in for shorter than ears. And they've got 2 new spots this year. Area 115 is going to be a new hunt this year for shorter than ears. And then area 78, the spot where there's some smokers out there, some nice big bucks out there. Then 105 through 107, then 121, that's a new area for shorter than ears. And that's a lot of fun. That's a fun hunt. That was the first hunt my wife went on, and she had a blast. She didn't want any pressure of having to shoot a buck.
Right.
And it just adds a little more enjoyment.
Oh, I would absolutely agree. Yeah, I got no problem shooting does, cows, whatever. I'm perfectly content to do so. And like you said, it's a more casual experience. There's not that stress of a 300-class bull or whatever the case may be. Yeah.
And there's a lot of tags for that shorter than ears. You got that area 6 that we were talking about, area 6 and 7. I mean, there's over 200 tags available for shorter than ears. That tells you how many animals
are in there. Yeah.
In that particular country. So
backing up real quick, one of the units you mentioned, I will put this out there as a, we'll call it a public service announcement. unit I have hunted unsuccessfully, mind you, had opportunities and just didn't, for whatever reason, didn't pull the trigger. But 011, if people listening out there are putting in for that 011 unit, be very cognizant of the private land in there.
Yeah.
That is, it changed dramatically. My dad took a hell of an antelope out of there, gosh, now 8-9 years ago, something like that. Well, fast forward 3 or 4 years, I thought, let's go back up there. That's where I'm going to put in for. My hunt was dramatically different.
Yeah.
A lot of those water sources out there in 011 have been gated. There are, I don't know if they're monitored or not, but they have security cameras on fence posts. It is a dramatically different unit from 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, a lot of that went private.
Yes,
I mean,
a good
significant
chunk.
Amount of, and I think that's probably why back, you know, several years ago, there were 15, 20 tags or so for that 0011 tag. Now there's 2.
Oh, yeah.
And that's probably why, because the private land has decreased the huntable land.
It was that postage stamp hopping from, you know, public parcel to public parcel. And it seemed like all the areas were now locked up and couldn't get around them. And I don't know. Everybody knows how the rumor mill works. I don't know the legality of blocking access to some of those springs.
If it's private, they have the water rights. If they own the water rights to that spring, then
It is legal.
It is legal. So.
We know a family that has a ranch out there in Via in 011, and there was a little bit of scuttlebutt about the as far as blocking the roads going to certain areas. But that is an entire show in and of itself.
Yeah.
We don't have to go into all that. But I do want to make listeners aware that if you put in for that 011 unit and if you haven't been out there recently, it has changed. Stay tuned on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thanks for hanging in there over the break. We were going to talk a little bit about prepping, getting your gear ready, knocking the dust off. This is going to be a recurring theme until the season rolls around, but I will use a personal example of how things can change weekend to weekend with gear. First segment, we talked about the 3D shoots, Winnemucca. Everything was perfect, dead on. All my pins were, you know, hitting where they should be. Everything worked great. Now, my, we'll call them redneck tendencies, or for lack of a better term, you know, I throw my bow, no case, in the back of my car. It's rattling around back there. My kids' bows are rattling around back there. I have a case. I'm just too lazy or stupid to put my bow in it sometimes. Suddenly, everything 30 to 39 yards, everything's 3-4 inches high. So at some point, rattling around without a case in a matter of 2 weeks, my bow is now no longer zeroed at these certain yardages, and it happens that fast. So there are those people out there where you knock the dust off, you go, you fire 3 rounds of ammunition, you go, okay, I'm good, I'm zeroed, I'm close enough, I'm minute of deer at 100 yards, and it's like a Band-Aid. It might get you through a little bit, but you need to be getting your equipment out and checking it.
No, I agree. I've noticed that with a few folks that I've hunted with, where they've taken a shot on an animal and they are just like feet off. They get to looking at their gun or the muzzle loader or bow and they're like, huh, there's a rattle, you know, and they find out that the rest is, you know, on the bow is rattling. The drop away rest isn't dropping all the way, you know, all kinds of different knick-knacky things. So that's why I always recommend marking. Once you get everything dialed in, is to mark it.
That's, you brought that up with Dustin. I think that is a great tip.
Yeah, just to mark it. So on an ATV, a side-by-side, bouncing around through the mountains, I don't care if your gun, bow, crossbow, whatever it is you're shooting, muzzleloader, is in a case or in a sock or something, when you're driving along, that thing's bouncing around. So if you haven't checked all the equipment, made sure all the, you know, the Allen screws are tight, you may have an issue.
And I mean, beyond just the simple stuff rattling loose, you know, or in my case, a pin slightly shifting, besides all that, there's the component setup, you know, making sure powder goes bad after a while. There is a shelf life to that stuff. So even though, hey, you might have bought those Pyrodex pellets for your muzzleloader 10, 15 years ago, you might have a handful left. They're not going to ignite at the same rate that they did years prior. And same thing, I'll out him a little bit on air. I got on my dad. He and I had a discussion about this with his arrows. It's crazy making to me when he shows up and he shot phenomenally well in Fallon, wound up, I think, at the end of the first day, fourth place overall for his division. But he shows up and his arrows are all different lengths.
He asked me about that.
Yeah, there's three of them that are the same length and have the same fletching pattern. It's like, okay, those are your three arrows. Don't touch any of this other stuff. Now is the time to start. For God's sakes, if you don't have at least half a dozen arrows that are the same length and fletched with the same fletchings, go to a local shop, man. Go get some arrows. Don't cheap out on it. My head explode.
Yeah, even just if you know, with archery wise, just take your bow down there and ask them, hey, is this thing tuned?
Does this look right?
Is this bow okay? I mean, they'll check the strings, the cables, make sure all that stuff's dialed in. You don't want to be out in the field and have something malfunction, have something break. You know,
no.
They'll check the axes, the third axis, all of that on your sight and paper tune it. They'll get you to where you're feeling good about your equipment. Like muzzleloader wise, I've shot muzzleloader. I've loaded them, you know, through someone showing me how to do it because I was like, I have no idea what's going on here. Beyond that, I don't know much about muzzleloaders themselves. I've been really interested in picking one up, learning how to hunt with one, and, you know, putting in for some muzzleloader tags because that to me looks pretty cool. It's like the in between archery where you got to stalk and get real close. You still have to stalk and get pretty darn close. And it's not like rifle where you can, if you're proficient, which I'm not either with a rifle, but you can reach out there at, you know, 500, 600, 700 yards if you wish to. But you definitely don't have to get 50 yards from an animal. So
it's a happy medium.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I've been out shooting muzzleloaders with friends and they've had older powder. I have noticed that there is times where there's a delay more so than like fresh powder, or fresh Pyrodex or the pellets.
Pyrodex pellets. Yeah, the formed things.
In.
Right.
Yeah,
no, there's a shelf life to that stuff. And, you know, for those of you listening out there, if you reload, there's a shelf life to powders. That stuff breaks down over time, and especially when it is stored in a garage that's maybe not temperature controlled and it gets cold during the winter, hot during the summer, that will decrease the shelf life of powders. Now, obviously, bullets, it's a metal, you know, a copper jacketed lead chunk. No issue there. You know, you could find bullets from hundreds of years ago and they haven't been used. They're good to go. But powder does... I mean, the actual bullet, the projectile itself, you want to load up with that stuff, you're good to go. But powders do degrade over time, and you need to make sure. I just experienced, this is another here, real world example of something I've messed up. I had some IMR 4831 powder for my 25-06. We had a pet load with 117 grain Sierra Spire Point boat tail bullets. That gun, quarter minute gun all day long, meaning basically it could hold a quarter of an inch group at 100 yards all day long.
Oh, okay, I'm glad you explained that because I was thinking like Fast and Furious, like, oh, is that like a 9-second
No clock involved.
No, okay.
But yeah, so quarter minute, I mean, just stupid accurate clover leaf group gun. And I had IMR 4831 powder from God only knows when my dad got it. It's probably sat in a garage for 15, 16 years. I used some of it, same pet load, same primer, same bullet, same brass, everything the same. Only difference was instead of using fresher powder, I used this old stuff. And suddenly my quarter minute at 100 yards load is now a minute and a half, meaning an inch and a half, 2-inch group at 100 yards. And I'm going, well, what in the hell changed? It was old powder.
Yeah, just old powder.
So prepping for
different
this upcoming...
Different velocities, possibly.
Oh, 100%. I ran it through a chronograph. It was much slower.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Something that powder degrades. So the whole point of this segment is, hey, go through what you got. Everybody's hot to trot right now on putting in for stuff. But remember, if you draw it, you're going to have to be equipped to actually fill that tag. I can't recommend enough. Start setting up your arrows now. Go through your powder. Check the manufacturing date on the can.
Yeah. And not only just weapons, and just your gear in general.
Very good
all
point.
All of your
yeah.
hunting gear, everything that you're going to be throwing in your truck, just check it all out. So
does my tent leak?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's going to be a future segment. We're going to get into the backcountry with the binos and the scope, and how do you do some good old fashioned scouting?
Absolutely.
How do you glass? I mean, what's the best things you can do? What's your best vantage points when you're in certain canyons? So all that stuff starting to creep up on us. I know I'm slowly going through all of my outdoor backpacking hunting boxes and kind of cleaning shop, getting rid of some old stuff and replenishing, some things that I'm like, yeah, I'm not using that or I'm not eating that.
Yeah. That mountain house has expired.
Yeah.
And boy, those things last about 20 years. So if it's expired, you know it's bad.
I don't know if they last 20 years anymore, man. I had one that I had. It was dated 2016. And my son and I went up backpacking last year and cracked that dog open, sealed it, let it cook, do its thing. Went to take a bite and it was like, oh, yeah, this is not good.
This is turned.
This is not a good.
What was the meal?
It was like teriyaki chicken.
Oh, I don't like. I'm a beef ravioli or a beef and noodles guy. So
yeah,
chicken teriyaki.
Yeah, well, it's one of the ones that doesn't have yeast. I can't do yeast. So
that's right. That's right.
But yeah, I took a bite of it. It was like cardboard and chicken poop.
Yeah,
like the smell of chicken. I've never eaten chicken poop. People,
yeah, all right, Dave,
have not done it. But the smell of chicken poop and cardboard.
Okay, yeah, texture of cardboard, smell of chicken poop. Hey, on that note, we're going to wrap up another Sunday here on Nevada Backcountry. Thank you guys for tuning in today. Next week, we will do the Mountain Tough Plus Suite drawing. So one of you lucky listeners out there, you're putting in for tags. You will be able to get in shape for the hunt, courtesy of David Catalano. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Coming up at 11, Tom Gresham's Gun Talk.